Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast. I'm delighted today to be joined by Emma, and she's the founder of Children of Transitioners. And she's written with breathtaking candour about her father's decision to identify as trans and how that impacted her. And now she's set up a group, Children of Transitioners, which brings together people whose parents identify or have identified as trans. And she advocates for the rights of children, because I think children's needs are quite often overlooked and overshadowed by the decisions taken by parents and the institutions that support them to transition. So you can follow Children of Transitioners on X at Children of Trans. So hello, Emma.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, it's lovely, lovely to speak to you. And could you maybe explain a little bit about Children of Transitions membership and what it is that you actually do?
Okay, well, it started a few years ago, and I was already interested in feminism and I was becoming gender critical, and I started to think perhaps I should, you know, put my oar in and talk about my experience and how it's relevant and things like that. So I set up a site and I started to just write about my experience, and then a few women contacted me, and it's all women so far. We're all around the same age as well, which I think might be possibly because we've reached a time when we can put some perspective on it. We're all over 50. I think one of the interesting things about having a father, sort of a late stage transitioner, is that you often recognise the same patterns of behaviour when you start looking at other people, even though obviously there are differences in background. We intended to form a support group. You know, most of my writing was about the emotional experiences, but we've ended up doing a lot of campaigning, mostly because we saw how institutions have been captured and the obvious problems arising from that. So hospitals, schools, the police, courts, social workers. In the UK, that Stonewall influence has just been insidious, really. And we feel that a lot of these places have become more hostile to young people who have a trans parent. So we sort of look back and we sort of think, gosh, if this was me, how would I have reported anything going on in my life? Because they're not listening to us. You know, and you can see that all over the place. You walk into a hospital, hospital's got the trans flag up. You know, the police have the trans flag on the side of their vehicles. You know, schools have all this affirmation stuff everywhere. How can you talk about your experiences? You know, this became the thing. And we're starting to see in the media a lot of children of transitioners. You know, when I was... when my dad came out to me in, you know, 1982, there were hardly any transsexuals in the UK, hardly any. And now, what, thousands, hundreds of thousands, so many late stage transitioners. And of course, what we've seen is that quite often late stage transitioners, this is sort of men who come out after their adolescence, often get married and have children. And then when the children have arrived, then they reveal that they are trans. Right, that tends to be the pattern that we're seeing. You know, the woman wrote a book a couple of years ago about how she got pregnant, she had the baby, and then he says he's trans. The Debbie Hayton book. Yeah, they, you know, they get married, they have babies, and then he says he's trans. Even though he says, like, I knew I was trans since I was 4, what we're finding, what the trans widows talk about as well, is a kind of deception, you know, and then the babies arrive and women feel trapped. So that's kind of that experience.
Thank you. That's really interesting. And I know that, you know, so talking about institutions there and institutional capture, and I know that Children of Transitioners has had a bit of a sort of media win recently with bringing attention to a policy at Sussex Hospital or Sussex University Hospitals Trust.
Yes.
Could you sort of explain a bit more about your role in that?
Right. So we published a letter that we got from Sussex NHS Trust. We have been sending out freedom of information requests to many trusts about this issue of helping men lactate, right? And air quotes, feed their baby. It kind of came to our attention, I think, last year. You remember this, you might remember the story about Mika.
Yep, I did.
He was in a newspaper report and then took a selfie of himself lactating on a bus with his baby. And then we just sort of thought, hang on a minute, who's doing this? How is this being enabled to happen? And then you sort of, you realise there's a whole culture of it. And, you know, worst case scenario, I think, is this guy, Nominal Naomi, who claims to be in the top 3% of OnlyFans content providers, who calls himself a human cow and lactates and has kids. And, you know, it's what's very obvious is there's a sexual content to this. You know, Mika, when people delved into his social media, had lots of things about going to Berlin and trying on nipple clamps, yeah. You know, and even like wanting a uterus transplant and things like that. These are all, you know, things that we're familiar with as, you know, the sexual nature of transition, you know, like ourselves and trans widows, we're, you know, the uncomfortable truth people who talk about this kind of thing. So we have been writing freedom of information from various hospital trusts, and some of them, because we mentioned the sexual content, a few of them did not want to respond because we were being offensive and discriminatory for the language that we used. Okay. Right. So we called, like, you know, liquid secretions, or we talked about men doing these things, and some hospitals couldn't cope. Sussex NHS Trust, we've singled them out because of the letter, but also York and Scarborough NHS Trust, lots of NHS trusts have exactly the same, absolutely the same policies. And also, I think it's worth noting, as we discovered, that you remember the rainbow badges scheme?
Yeah.
That also required people to affirm men and help them lactate. That was part of that scheme. Right. So these are all the things that we've uncovered as right. part of this. Yeah. We were sort of doing this independently, and then we got in touch with Lottie Moore at Policy Exchange because she asked people to contribute kind of the effects of gender ideology and things. So we got in touch with her, and she's, Policy Exchange has been very kind about publicising it and kind of helping us, you know, talk about what we discovered, which was the contents of the letter, you know. Quite worrying that they were claiming there was scientific basis for a man feeding a child, you know, that it was, that the lactation that he was producing was the same as mother's milk. I know a lot of people have done work on that, you know, like on, have gone through all the scientific papers and I said, well, you're giving a child domperidone. This came out around Mika as well, who was on his way to chemo at the time, so he was taking some of these drugs that might have helped him lactate. But domperidone, at the kind of amounts that men have to take, so women take it sometimes to induce lactation, but they do it the once because then the lactation starts. But men have to take domperidone all the time. What we discovered, and lots of people have talked about, is the fact domperidone is passed on to the baby, and it's cardiotoxic, I think is the term. It can basically, it can stop your heart.
Oh God.
So, you know, from our perspective, you know, and for us, we're often imagining ourselves in that position, you know, with a father who wants to feed us, and thinking about the fact that people might actually be killing their babies in using them to validate their desire. You know, the an aspect of autogynephilia is that desire for, you know, to be part, you know, to have women's physical functions and things like that. There's no scientific basis for a man feeding a child, you know, and a couple of decades ago, it would have been completely unacceptable. But what was interesting was we were approaching these hospitals and saying, what are you doing? Where's your safeguarding? Right, for that child. Not one of these hospitals could produce any evidence that they did safeguarding for these children. We got, you know, like you can see in the Sussex letter, it's like, we take safeguarding training and we take safeguarding very seriously. But when we say, where is your safeguarding material, you know, it's not there. And they wouldn't produce it. That's deeply worrying.
Absolutely.
It's horrifying. Yeah.
And I mean, I think something that sort of obviously shines out of that isn't just the fetish element, but the idea of these men being so intensely narcissistic that they are prepared to use a baby as a prop in their own fantasy. Is that something that you'd say is common, perhaps, to fathers who identify as trans?
Well, the common pattern is of someone with a narcissistic personality disorder. We talk about autogynephilia, which most of these men have. This is what literally where you fall in love with yourself, right? That's you fall in love with the idea of yourself as a woman. This is completely self-involved. You know, I mean, I've written quite a bit about this sense that I lost my father, right? My father became this person who was just completely involved with himself. And there was no space in that love affair, no space there for you. You know, so there's often quite a lot of neglect. You are treated like a prop. You're treated for validation. You're kind of wheeled out to show that your dad is a great mother and those kind of things. But you're not given much care yourself. This is that squared, isn't it? I mean, this is the absolutely worst case scenario.
And I guess the sort of looking at these sort of Instagram influencers and all the rest of it, there's sort of a culture seems to have developed around normalizing this. And what do you think sort of the wider implications, sort of the social implications might be from sort of normalizing these for children?
Well, one of the things is you're not supposed to really, as a child of a transitioner, have any emotions yourself or agency yourself or feelings for yourself. And I've actually been sent some screenshots and things of them talking about how to deal with children, you know, and the whole idea is kind of like, you want your kids to just shut up and behave because you don't want them, you know, to in any way harsh the buzz of you cross-dressing and you doing all these things. And you can see it. You can see it in the Reddits and the Instagrams. You can see it in the celebrities who are doing it. You know, they're taking pictures of their kids. They're using their kids as props. What I feel is the normal safeguarding that you would expect for most children just doesn't seem to happen at all when you put trans into the mix. Does it? I mean, it's like a pregnant woman, you know, in the sort of history of me reading about pregnancy and women have been told, you know, you remember like absolutely no drinking, don't eat certain kinds of cheese, have happy thoughts. You remember like you mustn't be depressed when you're a pregnant woman, play Mozart to the fetus because then the fetus will be more clever. Remember all of these things. Yeah. Women aren't allowed to take painkillers. They're not allowed to do all kinds of things. But the minute you inject trans into it, a woman can take huge doses of testosterone all through their pregnancy. That was the, you know, the latest advice was, well, if you're feeling dysphoria, take your T anyway, even though we know that it may result in damage to the fetus. That's okay though, right? So hang on a minute. Women were supposed to think good thoughts and not eat cheese. And now you can actually inject testosterone that you know is going to damage the baby. Or you can feed a baby domperidone that you know could very much stop their heart. Hang on a minute. The minute you put trans in, suddenly the safeguarding disappears. That's worrying. Why are these children not getting the normal safeguarding that you would with another child?
And I mean, I think sort of trans-identified women tend to get overlooked in this, so those who identify as trans men. But I suppose there's also an element of narcissism to that, to sort of, you know, put in yourself, and you know, I find it absolutely bizarre that you have women who claim to be triggered by being called she or her or mother, yet they can give birth and apparently aren't triggered by that. Would you know of any sort of studies of any sort of about the sort of longer term impacts of testosterone on sort of developing fetuses, and are there any sort of, because obviously, you know, we know about the
Yeah.
reverse, but is there any evidence that that it harms?
Well, we know that, like women in menopause sometimes give birth and they tend to have babies at much lower weight. It's not an ideal thing when you've kind of gone through that fertile process, which of course the menopause is something that you accelerate by taking testosterone early. Years ago, I saw a study that disappeared really, really quickly, which seemed to suggest that women who were taking a lot of testosterone and then having babies, when those babies got to puberty, particularly male babies, they were kind of prone to extreme rages and things like that. It's kind of made sense, I think, if there's a lot of testosterone in your body. We haven't got to the point, have we, where any of the, well, if they have daughters, which is less likely, what's going on? Because the ovaries in those girls are formed in their mother's womb. So
Slightly,
what
I'm
happens
sorry, but
when they have children? And it's not going to be that long before they have kids. And what are those kids going to be like? What's happening there? We have no research. This is all experimental. Where is the research?
and with regards to sort of moving away from the medical, with regards to the psychological, what sort of, well, if you don't mind me asking, what impacts it had on you?
I think there's a lot of trauma. You know what I mean? I think it's really difficult to describe how destabilizing it is when your father does this. Because my mother was ill, I lived with my father through his transition. And, it wasn't easy in any way. So living with someone with a narcissistic personality disorder anyway is difficult. It's also shaming. Fathers who transition, they've got this condition that's partly an idea that they're going to show women how to be better women, that they're going to be better than women, and in what they do. So they're going to show you how to dress, aren't you? And they're going to show you how to do it. And if you are a daughter of a guy like that, you're never going to be pretty enough or feminine enough. You're never desirable enough to men because you're the child of a man who feels that a woman's purpose is to be desirable to men. And you look at, say, for example, Jan Morris. The stuff that came out last year about Jan Morris was that he didn't think his daughter should have the same education as his sons, right? Girls were to become secretaries and then get married. He wasn't going to pay for her education. They don't, they being a child of a man with those kind of attitudes or that kind of belief about women is really, really upsetting. Very, very destabilizing. I know, some of the things that have happened, like people have reported to me, there's one which I've written about. This was kind of literally a friend of a friend, where the father, having announced his transition, his daughter was doing something like a dance recital. He walks into the changing room with the girl and all her friends. And so one of the mums says, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he's like, "Well, I'm a mum now."
And I guess
So
that's
eventually,
humiliating and embarrassing for her as well,
can
to.
you imagine that's you and your friends? There's bits where, like the dad wants to go to a bra fitting with you because you're both growing breasts. He wants to do a makeup thing with you. He wants to talk about clothes and boys and, all that kind of thing because he's a girl now. And you see that all over the place. And that can be like really, really destabilizing and traumatizing.
Horrible.
But one of the things is like, you love your dad, right? This is part of the problem, right? You love your dad. You can't divorce your dad. And you want to please him. And what you see quite a lot of the time is young women become their father's champion. You know, despite the fact that, you know, children's charities will say the worst thing you can do for your child is to make them responsible for your emotional state. But you do, right, when you're a child of a man like this, because you love him. And what that love is, he tells you that what that love is being his champion. You know, someone from Stonewall wrote a children's book called Nothing Ever Happens Here, in which basically a young girl does that. She goes on the radio and talks about how amazing her dad is because he's transitioned. And it's just, it's not just that that's what your dad as an individual wants. This is now what society is expecting from you. You know, we talk about be kind and allyship and that kind of thing. And, you know, as I've said, one of my worries is that kids go into schools. I know of a young woman who was trying to talk about her father, who was okay with being called dad, who was okay with being, because, you know, and got corrected by the teacher. Right? No, you can't use that language.
Oh, God, that's that sort of gaslighting institutionally, gaslighting at home, gaslighting at... That must be incredibly destabilising.
It is, and I mean, very early on, I started to think, you know, what happened in our house, which was a very controlling, you know, what my dad felt, what my dad said was the most important thing there, is now meta. It's out there. It's in society. You know, that it's what the trans activists want. And I'm just like, suddenly what had been my private hell has kind of expanded, you know, to all of these institutions. And this capture, you know, you think about this NHS trust that is enabling men to lactate. How on earth did we get to this point? And when you say something about it, you're the problem.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting to draw attention from the sort of the micro to the macro, and that must be really, really unsettling to see it play out. I've heard anecdotally from conversations that I've had with trans widows that, and I don't know if it's it might just be a few examples, but I've come across it a few times now, where sons in particular start to identify as trans in households where there's where the father identifies as trans. Is that a pattern that you've come across, and what do you think perhaps explains it?
I mean, to be fair, we're mostly female as a group, really. I've been in contact with a few men who want to talk about their father's transitioning. There's quite a powerful piece up on the web about a young man who's kind of like, his father, the part of the problem was, you're trying to grow into manhood, you want to be a man, and your father is running away from that. And part of running away from that, of course, is denigrating that, right? The most worthless thing that you can be, I suppose, is a man in that kind of household, right? And, you know, so no one comes and cheers your sporting achievements. No one is there to help you learn to shave. All those things don't happen. And I think, you know, when you think about those schools where they've got the gender ideology, you know, the drag queen story hour kind of places and things like that, one thing that you really notice is how destabilized children are. It's a deliberate thing, isn't it, to destabilize children's identities. They just at the point where authority figures are supposed to help them understand stable reality, someone comes along and says, boys can be girls and girls can be boys, and, you know, all of those things. And I think for boys, that can be even more unstabilizing, you know, like, you know, I'm interested in it myself as well, you know, no research at all. But some of the trans widows who've contacted me have done so because their sons are in the most awful pain. You know, there was one whose son was autistic and he just wouldn't leave the room, he wouldn't leave his bedroom because he just couldn't cope. You know, and quite often, you know, these marriages fail quite often. Dad has spent all the money on clothes and makeup and surgery. And so quite often you lose your house, you lose all your stability, you know, and I just think there's a lot of pain there. I don't know enough men to talk about it, but the ones that I do meet who do get in touch are, you know, want to talk about how difficult it's been.
I think sort of tying up the wider sort of impact on the family as well, that's so important. And so often I guess these sort of personal elements are overlooked when it's seen as a political fight, which obviously it is, because you know it's thread through every bloody institution now. But but yeah, and it must be an awful thing to have to live with. So you mentioned there were some sort of commonalities between the members that you have and the people that get in touch, and often the father will be a narcissist. What other sort of patterns do you think are sort of, have you noticed from the people that get in touch with you?
It is quite funny actually, when you hear the stories, you sort of think they'd be more different, you know, but the dad's abusive and narcissistic behavior is evident really quickly. And I think it's quite interesting because we use the term trans widows as well. And I felt the most remarkable feeling of grief, and I didn't understand it and I couldn't name it until I was much older. And every now and then someone comes on, you know, Twitter and says, your dad just started wearing a skirt, get over it. And it's like, no, really, it's grief. It's really, really difficult to express, but you kind of lose your dad. Your parents' marriage fails most of the time. If your dad stays in the home, that can be worse, much worse. There is a lot of shaming and secrecy, the gaslighting, the idea that what's going on is normal is very similar. You get groomed quite a bit. There's quite a lot of, I wasn't sexually abused, but I saw a lot of sexual stuff. I saw a lot of sissy porn. There's quite a lot of kind of adult material that I saw and witnessed. And that kind of grooming where it's kind of like, well, you're a special girl. You're more grown up. You're cooler. You're more intelligent. You can cope with this kind of thing. I've seen that happen to so many young women, you know, that you're part of a sort of special secret. You know, and when I share that with other women, they're like, yeah, that's kind of like how sexual abusers behave. I mean, I've talked about the financial abuse that goes on. I think it's important because, you know, in terms of the narcissism, suddenly there is no money for you. I remember like literally growing out of my clothes, there was no money because, and it wasn't that your dad stopped earning, it's just that your dad is now in love with himself and wants to spend all his money on that. So when we talk about these experiences, quite often I'll be talking to somebody and go, oh my God, that happened to me as well. I hadn't realised that that was the same, you know, but I think one of the reasons I always thought that my dad was an awful person who just happened to be trans, right, for years, because I was, you know, if you'd spoken to me 20 years ago, I'd have been like, I'm such a trans ally, you know, my dad's champion, la, la, la. But then I realised that everything, the alcoholism, the emotional abuse, narcissism, that's common. I didn't realise that was everybody. But it's pretty much, you know, like you can, honestly, it's so, sometimes so predictable when people tell their stories.
Thank you. And I suppose just to sort of to finish off, what are your plans with Children of Trans? What are your sort of next sort of campaign objectives, and how can people sort of get involved if they want to?
By all means, get in touch. I'd really love more people to get involved and write and help us with the FOIs, which have been exhausting. You know, I haven't actually written much for the site since, I've noticed, since July, just because we've been so busy on these things. But this time, what I have to say is, there's been a lot more interest and there's a lot more sympathy and a lot more understanding. I've just really noticed that. I think over the last 6 months that I think more people are understanding and have been listening to us. And that's brilliant. There was a little bit, I think, at a Let Women Speak event where a woman said, "No one listens to trans widows," and the whole crowd went, "We're listening." And I thought, yes, this is brilliant. Like, I think people are more aware. So feels like people have woken up. And the thing with the lactation is this is only going to get worse if we don't stop it, right? So, and I think a lot of women have had a very visceral reaction to the idea of men, you know, air quotes, feeding a baby. So we've got more allies, and we can see that with trans widows as well. We're never going to be a cohesive large pressure group, right? Most of us are traumatized and too traumatized really to speak. And by the time we've kind of got over that, we've got lives, you know, so it's only going to be a few of us who ever really take this into the political arena. But we're meeting with MPs and peers. We're invited to meetings. We've been invited to talk to, you know, liberals and all kinds of different political groups. And, you know, there are lots of attempts to get our perspective heard as we move into the election. We're really concerned that a Labour government will throw us under the bus over the GRA, right? And you know, when I've spoken to MPs, their reaction has been, yes, that's going to happen. I'm really sorry. That sort of spousal veto thing is going to be hurting a lot of women. And of course, including religious women who never seem to get, you know. Really, all we're asking is the same treatment that other people get. You know, like I went to this meeting at House of Lords and people were saying to me, you know, all the laws that could protect you are there. They're just not being applied. So it's very marginal voices here. You know, a few women, trans widows, children transitioners, and we're just saying, can we just get equal treatment? Why are we the ones who aren't? You know, I think that's really important.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, did you want to, was there anything else you wanted to add? Or?
Yeah.
I was going to say thank you so much for speaking to us and indeed for your work on this. I think it's absolutely vital, and I really, really hope that you start to get a proper seat that you deserve at the table, particularly when it comes to children's charities, who I think have behaved disgracefully on this. So thank you so much.
Thank you.